have the resources for a juicer. I know that may be a contradiction for people in other countries and poor countries. There are things that we used to do to be able to extract the juice from foods, to be able to still drink the juice. That is taking and pounding the fruit, mushing the fruit, and then squeezing it through a fine mesh cloth or through cheesecloth. If the cheesecloth is not available, a clean fine mesh cloth is adequate. Also, you can take vegetables such as carrots, potatoes, celery, parsley, and those type of foods and put them in a pot of steam distilled water. If you have liquid amino acids available, put that in there as well. If not, that's fine. And don't boil them. Just lightly cook the food for a half an hour and then let it cool for half an hour. Remove the vegetables and put them in the refrigerator for consumption later on and drink the broth. You will still get, that is a very potassium dense drink that you can have if you do not have a juicer available. So those are some of the things that you can do. We are out of time. Colonialism is bad for your health. We want to thank the Uhura Movement for hosting this show. Uhura Radio is a product of the African People Socialist Party. We want to say all power to the people, black power to the African community. Make a choice, 'cause I'm scared of the things that I might be missing. Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon. We're going to our father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man. Yeah. To see the unification of all Africans. Yeah. As it's been said already, let it be done. Children of the Rasta man, we are the children of the Maya man. Africa, unite, 'cause our children wanna come home. Yeah, yeah. Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon and we're grooving to our
Uhuru, and welcome to Africa Live on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've got an excellent show lined up for you today. But we're going to begin, as we always do, with some clips from the news. The illegitimate settler state of Israel violated a six-day ceasefire on Saturday as it sent commandos deep into Lebanon, starting a fierce gun battle. The ceasefire called for an end to Israel's genocidal offensive against the Lebanese people. This violation comes as no surprise to many around the world who saw the spirit of the ceasefire broken even before it began, as Israel intensified its attacks on the Lebanese people in the final hours leading up to the ceasefire's installation. Even after the ceasefire began, Israeli warplanes flew over Lebanon as if preparing for attack. The UN-brokered ceasefire also calls for intervention from armed forces around the world as part of a 15,000-troop UN force in the area. Israel, however, has objected to any country sending troops unless they have diplomatic ties to the illegitimate settler state and support its theft of the Palestinian people's land. It has rejected the idea of having countries like Malaysia and Indonesia send troops. Malaysia's Foreign Minister Syed Hamir Al-Bahr dismissed Israel's statement, saying, "We're going to be on Lebanese territory. We're not going to be on Israel's territory." Israel claims that the assault made in violation of the ceasefire was defensive and in attempts to cut off arms for Hezbollah. Notwithstanding the fact that the cutting off of arms to Hezbollah was not a condition of the ceasefire, the Israeli state has boldly stated that it will continue to break the ceasefire in this manner until the heroic Hezbollah resistance is prevented from rebuilding its arsenal. It has been suggested that the assault Israel initiated in violation of the ceasefire was an attempt to retrieve the captured Israeli soldiers that Israel claims was the reason they began the genocide on the Lebanese people, or to capture a Hezbollah leader to exchange for them. In other news, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the United Nations has added to its long list of offenses against African people, with recent reports of UN officials prostituting young African children. UN officials have reportedly been having sex with women and children in exchange for food or money. This is yet another example of imperialist white power taking advantage of the poverty that results from the parasitic relationship that it holds the world's colonized peoples in. The imperialists steal the resources of Africa and other oppressed peoples, leaving them poor, and then use the corruption that comes as a result of people scrambling for the scraps left behind as justification for their dehumanization. This is not the first time that UN officials have been exposed for sexually abusing colonized peoples in countries the UN claims to be helping. Other cases of sexual abuse by UN officials have come out of Cambodia, East Timor, West Africa, and previously in Congo, in addition to other places. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez said on Friday that the Venezuelan government had caught 4 U.S. spies. Meanwhile, the U.S. government denies that they were spies, as well as the possibility of U.S. invasion. Of course, U.S. President George Bush has labeled Chavez a so-called threat to democracy, and a coup attempt made in 2002 against the Venezuelan government was clearly led by the U.S.'s Central Intelligence Agency. President Chavez said that the 4 spies who were caught were sent back to the U.S. and has been calling on the Venezuelan people to prepare for the possibility of impending U.S. invasion. That's our news for today, and we'll be right back shortly with Africa Live on AhuruRadio.com.
how it goes. To ba fe se be o mi lo ma lo. If you want cook soup, now what are you going to use? To be bang bona o mi le ra re o. If your head is hot, now what are you cool on? To ma banda ba o mi lo ma lo. If your child they grow, now what are you going to use? If water kill your child, now what are you going to use?
Welcome back to Africa Live on AhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe. And like I said earlier, we got a great show lined up today. On this past week, many African people around the world have been celebrating a giant in the history of the struggle for the redemption of Africa and for self-determination for African people. Marcus Garvey's birthday was August 17th. And we thought it would be important to dedicate today's show to Garvey, who contributed so much to the African liberation movement. I have with me in the studio another giant in the history of Africa's struggle for freedom. I want to introduce Omalia Shetela, who's the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, leading organizer of the International Tribunal on Reparations to African People, and founder of the African Socialist International, among many other things that he's done. Uhuru Chapman.
Uhuru Africa.
It's always good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here. I thought it was, I just wanted to comment, I was really impressed by Sister Iyapo's show that preceded this show.
Yeah.
She does an incredibly significant job with this health issue, and I hope people listen to that and heed it. Yeah.
Yeah. I know I've gotten a lot of good information. There's some things I've stopped doing and some other things I've started doing.
Mountain Dew is out of the window, huh?
Mountain Dew is gone. Chairman, so these celebrations have been going on, you know, all around the world. I've seen, you know, the announcements, you know, over the internet and whatnot for celebrations, you know, from everywhere. And I wanted to have you on the show so you can, you know, give some context to the significance of Garvey, because oftentimes people, you know, we celebrate as African people, you know, we celebrate folks, oftentimes not Africans, not people who've contributed to our struggle, but in this case, this is somebody who is celebrating who has contributed a great deal to African people, and I thought it's important for us to understand who Marcus Garvey was. And I wanted to see if you could, you know, just speak to the significance of Marcus Garvey.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to do that, because as you mentioned, Garvey was an incredibly significant historical force, greater than most of us perhaps will ever understand. And I think that it is a good thing that around the world we've seen African people attempting to hold up the memory of Garvey. I know that as a young person, I made the mistake of joining the U.S. Army military fresh out of high school, because I was one of those who believed that growing up in a small city, what was happening, the limitations imposed on me as an African, had something to do with being in this small city. And I felt at the time that, listening to the propaganda put forth by the U.S., that joining the U.S. Army was going to open the world up and I would have all these opportunities, and it only took me a couple of seconds, literally, upon joining to find out otherwise. But one of the things that I found striking is because I also quit the U.S. military. I grew a consciousness in a very serious way while there, and at one of the, as a consequence of my actions to get out of the military, based on just rage that came with a certain level of awareness of how African people were suffering and some things about the history of that. The U.S. military decided I must be crazy, because at that point I simply summed up my opposition, my resistance, as being against white people. And I had, a serious rage. It's hard to describe it at this point. And so if I didn't like white people, they knew I was crazy, so they sent me to a psychiatrist, and ultimately the psychiatrist said, well, there's nothing wrong with you. You're a Garveyite. And I didn't know what a Garveyite was, and it's a part of what has been done to African people in terms of robbing us of awareness of our own struggle, our own history. What is a Garveyite? And it was only later that I remembered my grandmother telling stories about a man who would come to the churches and talk to our people about going back to Africa. And I was a very small child when my grandmother told me that, and it was just something that was in the recesses of my memory. It was not something that I was even conscious of until this contest that happened with me in the U.S. Army. So the fact that there are people around the world who are holding up Garvey is really important. And I like to think of this show and the the events that we are involved in as a part of that international process. And of course, on today also at 4 o'clock, we will be having an all-African meeting at the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg to talk about Marcus Garvey, to try and enhance the awareness of our folk about who Garvey was and the significance he had for our movement and has for our movement. I think also that when we talk about Garvey, we don't want to fall into that trap that so many people do, yes. Like they will deify Garvey,
yes.
And then make him godlike,
yes.
And somebody who we simply bring out once a year and talk about him, and that's it. But Garvey was not a god. He was a man who had a vision about not only about a free and liberated Africa, but about what it would take to make that happen. And he built an incredible organization. And there were millions of Africans from around the world who joined in this effort with Garvey to try and change our relationship with imperial white power. So simply to talk about Garvey as some kind of god or deity or the prophet and then to do nothing about it is not honoring Garvey at all.
Yes.
'Cause Garvey was not somebody who just talked. In fact, I remember reading a quote where a woman said that Garvey gave us backbone when we only had jawbone.
Yeah.
So it's not just a matter of talking to be like Garvey. One has to act. One of the things that is incredible is that, you know, I listen to people who talk about Garvey, and they said, well, Garvey did some interesting stuff, and they like to talk about the Black Star Line as one example because it was such a magnificent and huge effort that where somebody got these steamship lines to initiate trade between African people around the world. What an incredible venture. So it's not something that you can not acknowledge. But even when people acknowledge it, they do it begrudgingly often. And then they say, well, Garvey did this. But they talk about how Garvey just didn't understand anything about business. And he only had people working with him who were like yes men. Or people who didn't know what they were doing. And it's a real, like, on the one hand, they acknowledge it, and then they denounce it at the same time. But the fact is that we can say, yes, that Garvey and the movement had no experience running steamship lines. We're talking about the Black Star Line, which was organized in 1919, which was just some 50 some odd years after slavery was legally abolished in the United States.
Yes.
And where most of the African world, with Liberia and Ethiopia being the nominal exception, existed under colonialism. So it's not like there were a lot of people, Africans, running around with experience with the steamship line. And then secondly, the fact that Garvey was building a movement that was tied to the slogan Africa for Africans, those at home and those abroad, that was a part of an effort to end colonialism, meant that all the major economic powers and political powers in the world were waged against this effort that Garvey would have been involved in and the steamship line. And then to recognize this and to say that that Garvey, the steamship line, failed because of the ineptitude of Garvey, or that Garvey was some kind of egomaniac and therefore would not tolerate people who weren't simply yes persons, is a crime against the movement, that kind of articulation. That is simply the worst kind of slander, not only against Garvey, but against the movement.
Yes.
Because the thing is that you say, okay, Garvey, you say, was inept, and that's why the steamship line failed. Then how do you explain the fact that nobody else was even trying to do a steamship line?
Right.
Was it, okay, Garvey was inept, but what about the others? Were they inept and simply not visionary? I mean, Garvey was incredible. And then I think it should be stated that the FBI actually integrated itself.
Yes.
The first Negro coming into the FBI and to the Bureau of Investigation, that was a precursor for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the first Negro was integrated into the organization for the purpose of spying against the Garvey movement. And so the federal government of the United States put all kinds of forces and resources at work inside and outside the organization to destroy the Black Star Line to make sure that it never was afloat.
Yes.
I would say also that when you talk about the Garvey movement and the Black Star Line, you're talking about in 1919, when the Black Star Line was incorporated, it was known as the Bloody Summer in the United States, where white people were rioting and murdering Africans all around the United States. I think it was in St. Louis or East St. Louis, I can't remember which, where one of the worst so-called riots happened, where Africans were being murdered in 1919. And then, so this was a part, this is the era that Garvey was at work. And then, of course, just 2 years after the inauguration of the Black Star Line, you had the situation in 1921, where white folk, including the U.S. government, initiated an attack in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on the so-called Black Wall Street, which is an indication, if none other, of the hostility that white power had against the notion of successful economic enterprises by African people. If they were so hostile against economic success in a small place like Tulsa, Oklahoma, you can imagine the hostility that they had for an effort that Garvey was making to try and build an economy, an international, a global economy around which this dispersed African nation might be organized.
Yes.
That is the objective reality. So to talk about the ineptitude of Garvey is to align up with imperialism and to obscure the incredible significance of this effort, the visionary significance of this effort by Marcus Garvey. It is to become an apologist for imperialism, which many folk are doing. So I just think that you say the Black Star Line, but there were other things. There was the Black Star. The factories. I can't remember the factories that incorporated that Garvey created. And there were steam. There were dry cleaners, and there were radio and record production companies, and the dolls and. All of this came as a consequence of Garvey.
I understand also that I remember hearing someone speak recently about after the Hurricane Katrina situation, building something called the Black Ankh that would deal with Africans being able to deal with our own issues when disasters hit and stuff like that. But Garvey built the Black Cross.
The Black Cross nurses is what he created, and Garvey did was recognize the need to consolidate this dispersed African population into a nation conscious of its oneness, sameness on the one hand, and then to build the state apparatus that would be necessary to give this sense of national sameness and oneness leadership and coherence. And so there was he built a military component to this. I think it was the Black Legion something to that effect. He built the Black Star, the Black Cross nurses. So there were all kinds of components. There were ambassadors that had been established. And again, you know, you have to, people like at that juncture, especially educated and middle class Negroes, ridiculed Garvey for the ceremony that was associated with the movement, for the uniforms, for the titles that were given to people who were leaders. Like I said, there were ambassadors and grand plenipotentiaries and things like this. But what Garvey was doing at a time when I said, that, like as I said, there were only two nominally independent African, and that was only nominal, independent African so-called countries in the world, was to create a coherent framework and for a state apparatus that could give leadership to a whole people. And so he was an extraordinarily brilliant man and just did incredible work that must be remembered. And the success of the Garvey movement is what we really want to talk about, because Garvey was only allowed to organize for a very short period of time. I think he came to the U.S. in 1916, and by 1920, at least, he had created some 1,000 branches and divisions throughout the world.
Yes.
And an organization that had as many as 6 to 11 million members and supporters around the world. So it was like an incredible effort. And what Garvey did more than anything was to show us what our possibilities are.
Yes.
That we don't have to settle for the notion that we have to suffer peacefully, as Malcolm X might have said, with the circumstances we find ourselves confronted with, whether we're in the United States or someplace in the islands or in Europe or in Africa itself, that we can have a different kind of world if we would have the courage and the will to go out and organize ourselves to make the world that we want to be able to live in that's beneficial to us.
Yes, yes. Yes. Well, I wanna offer people the opportunity. Well, we're gonna take a break, but before we do that, I wanna offer people the opportunity to be able to participate in this discussion. So I'm gonna put out the contact information for people to do so. If you're calling from within the U.S., you can call toll free at 877-824-3337. If you're calling from outside the U.S., you can call. It's not toll free, but you can call country code 001-727-824-5700. And if you're not able to call, then you can also on the Uhura Radio website, on the right, you'll find a link that says email DJ. You can send us your comment and we'll read it over the air and we'll discuss it. We're going to go ahead and go to break, and when we return, we'll have more discussion with Chairman Amalia Shetella on the significance of Marcus Garvey.
Don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're door in Africa. No mind your complexion, there is no rejection. You're an African. Cause if your flexion high, 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 your flexion low, and if your flexion in between, you're an African. So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind denomination, that is only segregation, you're an African. Cause if you go to the Catholic, you're an African. And if you go to the Methodist, you're an African. And if you go to the Church of God, you're an African. So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, you have got the identity of an African. Cause if you come from Brixton,
you are an African.
And if you come from Easter,
you are an African.
And if you come from Wednesday,
you are an African.
And if you come from Bronx,
you are an African.
And if you come from Brooklyn,
you are an African.
And if you come from Queens,
you are an African.
And if you come from Manhattan,
you are an African.
And if you come from Canada,
you are an African.
And if you come from Miami,
you are an African.
And if you come from
shop, donate, and volunteer at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles for great deals on high-quality used furniture and unique treasures. Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles is a non-profit used furniture and collectibles store with outlets in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Oakland, California, and St. Petersburg, Florida. Uhuru Furniture Stores are an institution of the African People's Education and Defense Fund for genuine economic development for the African community. All donations are tax-deductible. Volunteer at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles to be part of a great community of people who have a true desire to change the conditions of life for the African community. To locate the store nearest you, visit apedf.org and click the Uhuru Furniture link. That's APEDF, the acronym for African People's Education and Defense Fund. Or simply Google Uhuru Furniture. Uhuru, welcome back to Africa Live. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've been talking with Chairman Omalia Yeshitela about the significance of Marcus Garvey. Chairman, one of the things that that we find often when people discuss Marcus Garvey, they raise him up as a Pan-Africanist. Or they raise him up, W.E.B. Du Bois up together, as if there was, you know, some type of as if they were in the same type of line, you know. And I've heard you discuss it differently, and I was hoping that you could you know bring some.
Yeah, some people do that because of confusion. They just don't know. Mm-hmm. And most people call themselves Pan-Africanists don't even know the history of Pan-Africanism, especially as it relates to the movement created by Marcus Garvey. But some people do know, and they are anti-Garvey forces. They despise Garvey and always did in the sense that they come from a particular tendency. Mm-hmm. That's a middle-class kind of Pan-Africanism, if you will. And Garvey is something that by now most of the Pan-Africanists cannot repudiate. You can't get around Garvey as having created the most significant movement that united African people around the world. The mm-hmm. only one that's done it relatively successfully. Yeah. And W.E. Du Bois, who was a great opponent of Garvey, had to give a begrudging kind of acknowledgement to what Garvey had accomplished. So a lot of times when you hear people talking about the great Pan-Africanists, they do so and they lump Garvey and Du Bois together. It is not because they are ignorant. It is because they're allowing Du Bois to hitch a ride mm-hmm. on the legacy of Marcus Garvey for yes. his own legitimization, and also as a means of curtailing the historical significance of Marcus Garvey. But the reality is that the Pan-Africanist movement, as a political phenomenon that realized itself in the world, was something born in opposition to the movement by Marcus Garvey. And it was created by W.E.B. Du Bois and the NAACP, the organization that Marcus Garvey used to refer to as the National Association for the Advancement of Certain People, recognizing its class content.
Yes.
And The Du Bois was one of the most ardent opponents of Garvey and the Garvey movement. And it held in 1919 this so-called Pan-Africanist Congress that was held in Paris. That was that Garvey denounced, in fact, because it was an attack on the movement by Garvey. And for people who may not believe that, I mean, we printed in this latest issue of The Burning Spear a letter that was in a newspaper, I think it was something like August 1921, in a New York newspaper where Du Bois, in a letter to the editor, wanted to clarify for those who had this tendency of mixing up the Pan-Africanist Congress with the Garvey movement. Mm-hmm. And he said quite explicitly that what we are about has nothing to do with the Africa for the Africans movement.
Yes.
And he said the Pan-Africanist Congress is simply a group of people who come together for the purpose of discussing, having these discussions and something that meant networking. And he said that that Garvey, we have to, you know, credit Mr. Garvey with the creating the idea of businesses for African people, but he is not the man to do it because he lacks poise and doesn't know how to do it, something to that effect.
Yeah.
And that same year, in August, at the Negro Convention of the World, where the UNIA held this meeting in Harlem, in New York, and where thousands of African people attended from everywhere in the world, including Australia and other places. Garvey put forth a resolution that was passed by that convention denouncing the Pan-Africanist Congress, and that was being held by Du Bois as an attack on the Garvey movement and as an effort to take people down the road of integration and something that was making money for certain individuals at the expense of the struggle for an all-African solution. So they were not the same. And I have to say that it's all right for different groups to have differences. In fact, one of the reasons there are different groups is because they have differences. But it is another thing for someone to actively engage and collaborate with the governments of imperialism to help to destroy movements, as Du Bois did with the U.S. government to help to destroy the Garvey movement.
Yes.
To the extent of actually trying to get the Attorney General of the United States to give him a ship. Now, Garvey went out and organized African people who put their nickels and dimes and quarters together and bought steamship lines, bought stock into our own ship. But Du Bois went to the federal government, to the Attorney General of the United States, to try and have him the U.S. government give him a ship that he could somehow use to intervene in the Black Star Line to destroy it. And he went so far to travel to Liberia, that Garvey that had gone to, not personally, but had actually sent emissaries, had bought land. Africans had bought land through the Garvey movement, had transported materials to Liberia, where Garvey intended to establish a beachhead. From which all of Africa would be liberated, and Du Bois, as an emissary of the United States government, actually went to Liberia with the intent of undermining that to prevent it from happening. Obviously, ultimately, the U.S. government and all those forces that included African petty bourgeoisie, some calling themselves socialists, some like Du Bois and other governments around the world, they all, and the Communist Party, I might add, not only of the U.S., but the Communist International, they all worked collectively and ultimately contributed to the atmosphere, and perhaps even more than that, that allowed the United States government to frame Garvey up on a mail fraud charge and used that as an excuse for arresting him and in 1925 imprisoning him, where after 2 years he was imprisoned, he was deported back to Jamaica, and the U.S. Government and all of the others, and the Du Bois and the Communist Party parties succeeded in destroying the Garvey movement. And I think you must see all of them as participating in that process. And the Pan-Africanist movement, Pan-Africanist Congress was a part of that effort, and it was a conscious part of that effort led by Du Bois. And I might say also that the Pan-Africanist Congress, it was a handful of intellectuals who were getting together in various places in Europe until after Garvey was arrested. In fact, after Garvey's death, the Pan-Africanist Congress did not. Garvey died, I think, in June of 1940. But the Pan-Africanist Congress did not approach anything like mass participation until 1945 with the Manchester Conference. And the Manchester Conference was a larger conference, in part because of the participation of George Patmore, who had been a part of the international communist movement and had worked with Africans in various places around the world. And there was a conference, a labor conference, happening someplace else in Europe, and he convinced a lot of these Africans to leave that conference at its conclusion and to attend the Manchester conference. And so that was a large conference. But the point that I would make, it took the death of Marcus Garvey before the Pan-Africanist Congress could become a meaningful in terms of significance and politically and in terms of growth. And some people like to point to the fact that Garvey's wife, Amy Jock Garvey, participated in the 1945 Manchester conference, some 4 years after Garvey had died, 5 years after Garvey had died. And her explanation for doing that was that she wanted to advance her husband's work. And yes, there were a lot of people who subsequently became involved in the Pan-Africanist Congress movement because they, too, thought it was a continuation of the kind of work that Garvey had initiated, which is one reason that a lot of people call themselves Pan-Africanists today.
Yeah. Wow.
But it's the problem with that is that there are all kinds of contradictions associated with Pan-Africanism. Our criticism of Pan-Africanism is not that just a couple of Pan-Africanists did some naughty things to Garvey some time ago.
Yes.
But as an historical trajectory which was born in opposition to a movement like Garvey, what were some of the key features of the Garvey movement? One, a critical feature of the Garvey movement was that its working class, essential working class composition,
yes,
which was one of the reasons the Negro intellectuals like Du Bois despised it, because they could not envision Africans, ordinary people being in motion, working class people being in motion. In fact, Du Bois is the father of the concept of the talented 10 that made the assumption only the 10% of the most talented, most educated Africans in the United States would be allowed by imperialism to provide the leadership for the rest of us.
Yes.
So one of the features of the Garvey movement they hated most was that it was rooted among African working class. Another feature of the Garvey movement was that it was a single organization with a single center, with a single philosophy, a single leadership. And this is one of the reasons, like the African petty bourgeoisie, which hate leadership, always denounce Garvey because they say, well, Garvey, you know, Garvey has had to be surrounded by yes people. But it wasn't like the petty bourgeoisie who get together just for intellectual masturbation. This was an organization that was trying to change the world.
Yes.
And it had particular kinds of rules and particular kinds of relationships and particular kinds of structures that were necessary. But it was an all-African organization, whereas
yes,
the Pan-Africanist movement has never been a single organization. It has been whatever. It's been these groups that's dispersed around the world. With their own little groups, and as Du Bois said, will come together occasionally. There's an 8th Pan-Africanist Congress, for example, scheduled for Zimbabwe in October. And again, people will come together and they will make discussions and things like that. They will network, and then they will go back and do their own separate individual things. That is not going to free anybody. So Garvey, that was another feature of the Garvey movement that made it crucial. And then another component of that was that Garvey and his movement assumed the responsibility for governing African people, did not assume that we would continue under imperialist domination.
Yes.
It assumed the responsibility for governing. That's why they created a military component and all these other components, ambassadors and other structures that's associated with actual having state power.
Yes.
That's, you know, that's not allowing for things simply to go along and we just call ourselves Pan-Africanists. And so this is a special feature. These were features of the Garvey movement as compared to the Pan-Africanist movement even today. So you had, coming out of the Pan-Africanist movement, you had a movement that was specifically
based on pacifism, nonviolence, pacifism,
yes,
as articulated by people like Du Bois and by people like Patmore. It was based on neocolonial assumptions, the permission and approval by imperialists. In fact, if you look at the 1920 resolution, that 21 resolution that Garvey introduced and that was passed at the convention in New York. I mean, he says, what kind of movement is this where they got representative of the governments, the white governments, the colonial powers, attending their meetings and participating in their meetings? And this yes. was, because it was neocolonialism. If you read George Padmore, whose book, Pan-Africanism, Communism, based on anti-communism, and it was a call more or less to the imperialist powers to accept Pan-Africanism in order to keep Africans from becoming communists. Yeah. So this is like a neo-colonial anti-communist, which is to say anti-working class based movement, that it was a movement based on parliamentarism. That is to say, going participating in some kind of governments, and that way getting colonial power to free us. So these were some of the contradictions as compared to the Garvey movement, which made the assumption through its own structures and through its own organizations, based in the masses of people as opposed to relying on imperialism. And what we've seen is that there have been great Pan-Africanists, people who, like Nkrumah, who attributes having read A Philosophy and Opinions of Marcus Garvey, edited by his wife, as being influential in helping him to understand some things. Nevertheless, after Garvey was gone, ended up participating in the Pan-Africanist work that was being done by people like Du Bois and Patmore, etc., and yeah. adopting the philosophy.
Yeah.
So as opposed to having a revolutionary philosophy, they had a parliamentary approach to stuff, and Nkrumah was able to go to power in Ghana through a so-called positive action campaign that allowed for voting to take place and the British to permit them to be free. And then, influenced by Nkrumah, Lumumba did the same thing, a positive action campaign that resulted in winning an election and the Belgium saying, okay, you're free. And then we had the incredible Robert Mangalisa Sobukwe from what they now call South Africa, influenced by Nkrumah and the positive action campaign that resulted in the Sharpeville massacre.
Yeah.
By now, that's how white folk had decided they were going to deal with it, so they shot everybody down. But then you see in 19, Nkrumah was able only to stay in power for 3 months before yeah. he was overthrown and then finally murdered. And then, I'm not Nkrumah, but Lumumba. And then Nkrumah was overthrown in 1966. And in every instance with Nkrumah and Lumumba, people in his own organization participated
yes.
either in getting rid of them, or if they did not actively participate, once they were overthrown, people in their own party then joined the opposition that participated in doing that. And one of the reasons is because they did not recognize the significance of class struggle. They did not recognize the significance of seizing power, taking power, but believed that it could be handed to them through the imperialists, and they were pacifists and therefore did not prepare to fight back. And it was only after Nkrumah was overthrown that he came to understand the question of class and the need for armed struggle as a means of which to come into power. So we've had great Pan-Africanists like those I've just mentioned, but Pan-Africanism led to their destruction, or the destruction of the movements that they led.
I want to invite people again to be able to participate in this discussion. The phone number here, if you're calling from within the U.S., you can call toll-free at 877-824-3337. If you're calling from outside the U.S., it's not toll-free, but you can call country code 001-727-824-5700. Or you can just send us a message by clicking on the Who Radio website, email DJ, which is on the right side now, and send us your comment, and we'll read it over the air and discuss it. Chairman, I want to ask a question just in terms of... I understand Garvey's organization was rooted in, mainly among the masses, the workers. Would the Garvey movement be considered a revolutionary organization?
Yeah, I think it would be considered a revolutionary organization, but a revolutionary nationalist and a kind of organization. Garvey's was around during a critical juncture at imperialist expansion, particularly by the United States, but it was the early part of the 20th century that the Garvey movement came to fruition. And this followed this era of where the 19th century was characterized in Europe as an era of nation building. And the Europe engaged in a process of nation building that resulted in the consequences of European slavery and colonialism of the rest of us. Then, but you saw at this time that the Garvey movement rose up, peoples who were making struggles for national liberation around the world, what people refer to as nationalist movements, from Sandino fighting against the U.S. in Nicaragua. You're talking about a period of where the Mexican Revolution was roiling, et cetera, even in China. If I'm not mistaken, one of the earlier Chinese nationalists that preceded the nationalist Chiang Kai-shek attended Garvey meetings in New York. So it was a time where you saw like these revolutionary nationalist movements emerging all over the world, and Garvey movement, I would characterize it as a revolutionary nationalist movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We got a call on the air, Chairman. I want to bring him on. Calling you on the air.
Uhuru, Chairman, it's really excellent discussion, and I had a question. You had mentioned, you talked about the Communist Party attacking Garvey in the U.S. I know you've spoken of that, but you also just referenced the Communist International in relation to, I don't know if you were saying in relation to just the Garvey movement or the Communist International in relation to internationally the African liberation struggle. I was just wondering if you could say some more about the relationship of the Communist International or the Communist movement internationally in relation to African independence struggle.
Yeah, the problem was that the whole struggle of Africans and other people who were colonized by European powers around the world found ourselves consistently fought by the Communist International. That saw itself as the leader of the so-called workers of the world, and that liquidated the struggles for national liberation that were being waged or attempted, but that were being attempted by oppressed peoples around the world. And so, yeah, the Communist International was a problem. And as an example, I will give you an example at a later time in history. For example, during the time of the Second Imperialist War, when Europe was fighting to redivide the world, that's effectively what it was, organizations from around the world, in Africa and Latin America and various other places, but certainly in Africa and Asia, when they would attempt, and in this country, Africans, to struggle against the oppression of colonial powers, say the British colonialism or French colonialism in Africa, or in India, or U.S. Colonial terror of African people in this country, because the Soviet Union had initiated a policy of an alliance against what they call fascism,
so that all the Soviet Union was united with all the white countries against fascism in order to protect the Soviet Union, then it prohibited any other movements in Africa or Asia or in the United States who might be struggling against our oppression from doing that, because it broke up the united front against fascism. And so, and which was really wild. I mean, for a number of reasons. One, the whole concept of fascism is should be hated by oppressed people around the world.
Yeah.
Because what is fascism? Except, and you don't get a decent definition. Well, all these scientists, scientific socialism come up with the weirdest kinds of definitions of fascism. But effectively, what fascism is when white governments treat white people the way white governments have always treated the Africans in Africa and in Asia and in North America. That's when they call it fascism.
Yeah.
They come up with a special characterization, like an exceptionalism for white people. Now you come up with another name. So in other words, in order to have this united front against fascism, then the Soviet Union prohibited all the different organizations that were part of the Communist International, Africans, Vietnamese, others around the world, from fighting against our oppressors, because to do so would have broken up the united front against fascism, you know. So, I mean, there's a history there. It goes back, you know, a long time. But that was one of the best examples of how this thing has historically worked.
Just a question on that, because I don't quite understand the logic, and maybe because it ain't logical at all, but of how that breaks up the united front against
fascism. It breaks
fascism.
Up the united front against fascism in this way. The Russians are now working with the French, the Americans, the British, because the Italians are part of the fascist movement. So you got Germany and Italy and Japan who represent the fascist movement. But they also got colonies of black people and yellow people and brown people, etc. So the black people and the red people and the yellow people and brown people, who make up the vast majority of the people on earth, can't do anything to free ourselves from the British, from the French, from the Americans, because that breaks up the unity of the white folks who are fighting against something that hurts white people. That's the lot. That's the way it really is. And many of us willingly participated in that nonsense, because consciously, in terms of our own consciousness, we assume. We see ourselves as some force that's auxiliary to the success of white power and white people. That's one of the problems with Du Bois and all his forces with that kind of politic. They could not imagine African people and others being in charge of our own future.
Yes.
So the thing that they did with Garvey has never ended. It has never, ever ended. And it didn't start with Garvey, and it didn't end with Garvey. It's just another expression of imperialism, what we used to call ideological imperialism, the assumption that white folks are the only ones whose ideas ought to provide leadership, and essentially, since those ideas protect the interests of white folk, whether they call themselves workers or bosses, etc.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to discuss further. I want to discuss further the continuity from Garvey's movement up to now, and the work that that the party is doing, among other things. But before we get to that, I want to play a clip that is purported as a speech made by Marcus Garvey. I was not able to authenticate it myself, but I did listen to it, and I think it's a great piece, and I thought it was a good idea to go ahead and play that on the show today. So I want to play this clip that is said to be Marcus Garvey making a speech. It's about 20 minutes.
improve and protect the millions and suffer. I decided to do the latter. There is no future for people who deny their past. My forebears, my grandparents, my mother, my father did not suffer and die to give me an education to slight, oppress, or discourage my people. Because whatsoever education I acquired out of those sacrifices of over 300 years, I shall use for the salvation of the 400 million black people of the people of the world. And the day when I protect my people, may God Almighty say there shall be no more light for you. Unequivocally rejected the racist assumption of much white American Christianity, namely that God had created the black man inferior and that he had intended Negroes to be absorbent class, hewers of wood and drawers of water. Well, I dedicated my view of man on the doctrine of Imago Dei. All men regardless of color are created in the image of God. Now from this premise followed the equality of all men and the brotherhood of all men. The biblical injunction of Acts 17:26 reminds us that he created of one blood all nations of men that dwell on the face of the earth. I was most interested in brotherhood within his own race. Because if Negroes are created in God's image and Negroes are black, then God must in some sense be black. If a white man has the idea of a white God, let him worship his God as he desires. We have found a new ideal. Because whilst our God has no color, and yet it is human to see everything through one's own spectacles, and since the white people have seen their God through their white spectacles, we have only now started to see our God through our own spectacles. But we believe in the God of Ethiopia, the everlasting God, God of Father, God of Son, God of Holy Ghost, the one God of all ages. That is the God in whom we believe, but we shall worship him through the spectacles of Ethiopia. For 250 years, we have struggled under the burden and rigors of slavery. We were maimed, we were brutalized, we were ravaged in every race. We are men. We have hopes, we have passions, we have feelings, we have desires just like any other race. The cries raised all over the world of Canada for the Canadians, of America for the Americans, of England for the English, of France for the French, of Germany for the Germans. Do you think it unreasonable that we, the black world, should raise the cry of Africa for the Africans? The Negro is a man. We represent the new Negro. His back is not yet against the wall. We do not want his back against the wall because that would be a peculiar and desperate position. We do not want him there. It is because of this that we are asking for fair compromise. Well, the Belgians have control of the Belgian Congo, which they cannot use. They have not the resources or intelligence. The French have more territory than they can develop. There are certain parts of Africa in which they cannot live at all. So it is for you to come together and give us a United States of Africa.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. We are not going to be a race without a country. God never intended it, and we are not going to build God's confidence in us as men. We are men, human beings, capable of the same acts as any other race, possessing under fair circumstances the same intelligence as any other race. Now Africa's been sleeping, not dead, only sleeping. Today Africa's walking around not only on her feet, but on her brains. You can enslave as we've done for 300 years the bodies of men. You can shackle the hands of men. You can shackle the feet of men. You can imprison the bodies of men. But you cannot shackle or imprison the minds of men. Rise down, black men, and dig. Reach up, black men and women, and pull all nature's knowledge to you. Turn ye around and make a conquest of everything, north and south, east and west. And then when you have wrought well, you will have merited God's blessing, you will have become God's chosen people, and naturally you will become leaders of the world. And as you bow down to the white man today, so a lot of races bow down to you and call you a race of masters because of the superiority of your mind and your achievements. Because no race has the last word on culture and civilization. They do not know what we are capable of. They do not know what we are thinking. They're thinking in terms of dreadnoughts, battleships, airplanes, submarines. You know what we're thinking about? That is our own private business. They'll give us credit for being able to use our minds. And with people becoming conscious of themselves, determined to use their minds, you do not know to what extent they can go. Liberate the minds of men, and ultimately you will liberate the bodies of men. We love the white race, not for social fellowship, but for the common brotherhood of God intended we should live. What satisfaction can anyone get in being happy and see his brother wallowing in filth, dirt, and disease? How can you be happy living in luxury and your brother's living in disease, and then when you try to help the one out of the disease, the subculture talks about disloyalty? Black men of Carthage, black men of Ethiopia, Timbuktu, Alexandria gave the light of civilization to this world. Ethiopia shall stretch forth our hands unto God, and princes shall come out of Egypt. Because classes, nations, races have been quite over for centuries. Who have merely borne abuse, insult, humiliation, whose forbearance can only be compared to the prophet Job, has likewise lifted his bowed head and raised it up to God's skies and cried out, I am a man, and demand a man's chance and a man's treatment in this world. But I shall teach the black man, I shall teach the black man to see beauty in his own kind and stop bleating his skin and otherwise looking like what he's not. Slavery, race mixture, miscegenation had occurred because the African woman had no protection from the slave master. Therefore, there is no need today for black people to themselves freely continue a practice that smacks so much of slavery. Our critics say that the race problem will be solved through higher education, through better education, than black and white will come together, that they will never happen until Africa is redeemed. Because if those who like W.E.B. Du Bois believe that the race problem will be solved in America through higher education, they will walk between now and eternity and never see the problem solved. God made man lord of his creation, gave him possession and ownership of the world. And you have been so darned lazy that you have allowed the other fellow to run away with the whole world, and now he's bluffing you and telling you that the world belongs to him and that you have no part in it. I don't have to apologize to anybody for being black, because God Almighty knew exactly what he was doing when he made me black. If black people knew their glorious past, then they would be more inclined to respect themselves. Yes, you heard of Johnny Walker Red and black. Well, he had his adversities, but he's still going strong. Well, I intend, with your help and God's grace, to continue. Because my work has only just begun. And future generations shall have in their hands the guide by which they shall know the sins of the 20th century. I know, and I know you too believe in time, but we shall wait patiently for 200 years, if need be, to face our enemies through our prosperity. When my enemies are satisfied, in life I shall come back, or in death even to serve you as I served before. In life I shall be the same, in death I shall be a terror. Then come to me to be the real Marcus Garvey I would like to be. If I may come in an earthquake or a plague or a pestilence or as God would have me, then be assured that I shall never desert you and make your enemies triumph over you. Will I not go to hell a million times for you? If I don't, my work will only just then begin. For I shall live in the physical or the spiritual to see the day of Africa's glory. When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me, for in the new life I shall rise up with God's strength and blessing to lead the millions up the heights of the triumph that you well know. Look for me in a world when there is calm. Look for love, grace. I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who have died in America, those who have died in the West Indies, and those who have died in Africa to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have passed through the colleges, the universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards. You race of imbeciles. You race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it.
We pray to God for vision and for leadership. And he has given us a universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies, but a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden at the heights of Calvary, when white men scorned you, when white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side, or the withered and water gushed, that man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it at the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we just ask that you just help us all up the heights. Oh, yes, the cause is grand, the cause is close. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on, oh, mighty ship of state, sail on. Sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of South Africa. Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history. Sojourner Truth is worthy of a place of sainthood alongside of Joan of Arc. Christopher Harris and George William Garden are entitled to the halo of martyrdom with no less glory than the martyrs of any other race. Toussaint Louverture's brilliancy as a soldier or a statesman outshined that of any other people, hence he's entitled to the highest place as a hero among men. Because Africa's created millions and countless millions of black men and women in war and peace, whose lustre and bravery outshine that of any other people. So why not see good and perfection in ourselves? We must inspire a literature and promulgate a doctrine of our own without any apologies to the powers that be. That's why this hour is under. Let sentiments and cross opinions go to the winds. We are entitled to our own opinions and are not obligated to abound by the opinions of others. If others laugh at you, return the laughter to them. If they mimic you, return the compliment with equal force. Because they have no more right to dishonor, discredit you in manhood than you have in dealing with them. Honor them when they honor you. Disrespect and disregard them when they vilely treat you. Their arrogance is but skin deep, an assumption that has no foundation in morals or in law. They have sprung from the same family tree of obscurity as we have. Their history is as rude and as primitiveness as ours. Their ancestors were running wild and living in trees of branches like monkeys as ours. They made human sacrifices, ate the flesh of their own dead and wild meat from beasts for centuries, even as they have accused us of doing. Their cannibalism is more prolonged than ours. When we were embracing the banks of the Nile, they were still drinking blood out of the skulls of their conquered dead. After our civilization had reached the noonday of progress, they were still living in holes with bats, rats, and other insects and animals. After we had already unfathomed the mystery of the stars and reduced the heavenly constellations to minute and regular calculus, there were still backwoodsmen living in ignorant darkness. Indebted to us for the benefits of civilization. They stole our arts and sciences from Africa. Then why should we be ashamed of ourselves? Their modern improvements to be reflected and resurrected by our generation and our posterity. Why should we be discouraged if somebody laughs at us today? Who's to tell what tomorrow will bring forth? Did they not laugh at Christ, Moses, Muhammad? Was there not a Carthage, Greece, and Rome? So we see and have changes every day. So pray, walk, be steadfast, and be not dismayed. Because as the Jew is held together by his religion, the white race is by the assumption and the unwritten law of superiority, the Mongolian by the precious fire blood, likewise the black man must unite in one grand racial hierarchy. Our union must know no crime, no nationality. But let us all hold together in every country, in every crime, making a racial empire upon which the sun shall never set. Let no voice but your own speak to you from the depths. Let no influence but your own rouse you in time of peace and time of war. Hear all, but attend only to that which concerns you. Your allegiance shall be to your God, your race, your country. Remember that the Jew in his political and economic origins always first the Jew. The white man is first a white man under all circumstances, so you can do no less. Be black, buy black, think black, and all else will take care of itself. Let no one inoculate you with evil doctrines to suit his own convenience. Charity begins at home. So first, for thyself be true, and thou canst not then be false to no man. For God and nature first made us what we are. And out of our own creative genius, we make ourselves what we want to be. Follow always that great law. Let God and the sky be our limit, and eternity our measurement. There is no height to which you cannot climb without the active intelligence of your own mind. Mind creates, and as much as we desire in nature, we can have through the creation of our own mind. And today, being scientifically the weaker race, you shall treat others only as they treat you. But in your homes and everywhere possible, you must teach the higher development of science to your children. And make sure that we have a race of scientists far excellent. For in religion and science lies our only hope to withstand the evil designs of modern materialism. Never forget your God. Remember that we live, work, and pray for a binding racial hierarchy, whose only natural, spiritual, and political limits shall be God and Africa at home and abroad. With God's dearest blessings, I leave you for a while. One love.
That was Marcus Garvey, a speech that we believe to be Marcus Garvey, and that was an excellent piece. That's man, that was significant. I mean, he said a lot of great things in there. And some of the things that stick out in my mind, one of the statements he made that you have to do what other people have done, in terms of to gain your freedom, and if you cannot do that, then you will die. And another thing that he said that stuck out in my mind was the statement that any leadership that would have you depend on someone else is a leadership that will have you enslaved. that was just significant. That was really significant, yeah, to me. Again, this is Africa Live. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we just played a speech that we believe to be Marcus Garvey, and we've been speaking up to now with Chairman Omali Yeshitela, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, about the significance of Marcus Garvey, whose birthday was August 17th, just last week. Chairman, one of the things that... is there anything you want to say about
this? I just thought it was an incredible presentation, and if nothing else, I mean, if you could listen to that speech today, and you wouldn't assume that it was something, a presentation that was made in the 1920s.
No.
I mean, it's an incredible presentation that, yes, and the message. Still resonates. The conditions that Garvey talked about then exist today, except in many ways they're worse today than they were when Garvey was alive.
Yes.
I just thought it was a very powerful presentation. He said in a very short period of time just so much. And also what's very clear in the presentation is that Garvey recognized the power of the psychology of colonialism, and his presentation evoked the kind of images and spirit that would try and throw off the shackles of a colonial mentality,
yes,
that we find imposed on us today everywhere. It's an incredible presentation.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that I wanted to that you had begun to go into, I think, and that I think we should discuss is the question. I've often heard you say that African internationalism, or Yeshitelism, which is the theory of the African People's Socialist Party, and even the work of the African People's Socialist Party, is a continuation of Garvey's legacy. Can you explain
that? Yeah, I want to say it's a continuation of Garvey's legacy that has been developed to make it consistent with the world as it exists today and the greater understandings that have come about as a consequence of that. But one thing I want to say first is that historically, since our captivity as Africans, either in Africa or those of us taken away from Africa, is there has always been a resistance, and there's always been a resistance that recognized our obligation, our responsibility to take back for ourselves our own land, our own consciousness, dignity, integrity, our own resources, and to be a self-governing, self-reliant people. And that tendency has never not existed, on the one hand. And Garvey was the sharpest, highest, best articulated, and best organized representation of that tendency. But if you go back, you can see it's always been there. I mean, we fought from the moment the invaders came to Africa. We fought on the ships. We fought after we got here, etc. And then you see that there has been another tendency which has tried to survive and advance through some form of accommodation, some form of accommodating imperialism. And that is most obvious in the kind of politic that Du Bois represented. And sometimes it's like a force like Du Bois, who is extremely well educated in terms of imperialist education, and extremely well indoctrinated, one might say, through the imperialist educational systems, who actually came to believe in the supremacy in many ways of these institutions. Even though Du Bois was a brilliant man, he could talk to you about the history of Africa, etc., but when it came to like a practical movement toward Africa and recapturing, I mean, he would say stupid stuff like African people in the United States and other places had been away from Africa for so long that we couldn't live there because of the heat and other very stupid kinds of things. And the reality is that you have that kind of politic. And then, you know, like the civil rights movement in the 60s, you had an articulation that didn't question whether Africans should be in charge of our affairs, but question whether or not we could be in charge of our affairs, given the power of white people, and demanded that we had to be pacifist because if you fought back, then we would die and couldn't survive, you know, that kind of thing. And so these are forces that capitulated more or less to the white power. And after and what you see is that generally speaking, the most significant movements that we've had, whether it was the Garvey movement, which has never been equal, or the original Nation of Islam, which took many of the concepts. It's been said that Elijah Muhammad, who was the one who is most closely associated with the Nation of Islam, actually was a part of the Garvey movement. You've seen that these are the movements that's grown to the extent that it's taken government intervention
in order to affect them, undermine them. The Black Power movement of the 60s, you know, when Africans were again rising up. And it didn't just happen here. It happened, we talked about Nkrumah, we talked about Lumumba, we talked about Sobukwe in South Africa and all over Africa. At the moment where we rise up to try to take over our own affairs, then there's this imperialist intervention that undermines it, assassinates our leaders, jail people, create terrible chaos and confusion, and then it would raise up these other forces who accept some alternative to absolute and total independence. And in the United States, after the Garvey movement was crushed in the United States, we saw the movements like the NAACP, and we saw other kinds of movements and that talked about integration. And you take throughout the 50s, the movement was for integration, not for independence. I'm talking about its broadest expression, its most popular expression. And these were defeatist positions. These were positions that community and its leaders had assumed after the movements that demanded independence, which had gone to great movements, had been movements which were developed by the people ourselves, as opposed to with organizations of the white power, the institutions of white power.
Yes.
It took the government to destroy these movements, and then it takes the government and white power to raise up these other alternatives. So that's what's happened historically. And after the Garvey movement, we had this whole civil rights period, which was a defensive posture that the movement had taken, led by the African middle class, petty bourgeoisie, asking for inclusion into the white power system. But at the juncture where it became possible for it to happen, the movement strengthens, consciousness grows, and then people move away from this defensive stuff of being, let me participate in this system born of slavery and genocide,
yes,
and then allow me to make my own way. Not allow me, but demanding the ability to make its own way. And the African People's Socialist Party is a part of that whole historical trajectory. We simply reject the idea, the notion that somehow any government founded, any country, any economy founded off of our oppression and exploitation and dispersal of our people, the attack and destruction of much of our national homeland, that's the entity that we should somehow try to assimilate into. We think that the very existence of such a government, of such an entity, something that challenges the right and humanity of Africans and other people. So we've been involved in a movement to rebuild the work that the movements that Garvey built. And this is, we don't do this blindly. We don't think Garvey was a god. He was incredible leader. He was a visionary that summed up so much of what it took for us to move forward, and did it better than anybody has ever done it. But he made some mistakes. I mean, for example, if you listen to some presentations, he talks about Europe for the Europeans, and you know, Asia for the Asians, or China for the Chinese, and he's actually gone so far as to say Palestine for the Jews, right? Because that was at a time where the Zionist movement was growing, and it was articulating itself as representative of an oppressed Jewish population, and the Palestinians, Arab people, did not have an articulation, did not have a voice. Nobody challenged it, so there was an assumption by many oppressed people. And I remember at some juncture my own development assuming that there was this heroic Jewish people who were in the Middle East, you know, fighting for democracy, etc. Yeah. But the thing is that Garvey was right in terms of his concept of having to organize our nation, and it being required to build an economic and life for ourselves, and a state power that's capable of advancing our interests, advancing and protecting our interests as a whole people dispersed around the world. And so, you know, much of our work has been organized and geared toward building the African Socialist International.
Yes.
And which is a revolutionary expression of 21st century Garveyism, that we need a single organization with a single center, with a single philosophy, that is an organization that ties Africans around the world into a single trajectory to liberate, unify Africa and African people, and to bring Africa back into the possession of the collective of African people worldwide. That's what we're about. And it also makes the assumption that we're going to have to fight to do it, that there, that the world will not be the same as a consequence of Africa taking back what belongs to us, because the world as we see it exists now, it exists as a consequence of what has been stolen from Africa and how African people have been dispersed around the world. So I don't expect our success to leave the world as it is, with the only difference being some free African people. I expect that the capacity, our capacity to realize the consolidation of the African nation, to realize the consolidation of a liberated and unified Africa and African people with our own state, with our own red, black, and green flag flying high, that it will change the world. And it offers humanity an opportunity, perhaps for the first time, to live in freedom and harmony, and certainly not in the kind of fearful oppression and exploitation that has come in the wake of the advent of imperial white power.
Right on. Well, we got about, Chairman, we got about 15 minutes left on the show. I want to ask, I want to, first of all, I want to open the lines up again for people to participate. You can call, if you're calling from within the U.S., you can call toll free at 877-824-3337. If you're calling from outside of the U.S., it's not toll free, but you can call country code 001-727-824-5700. Or you can send us an email by clicking email DJ on the right side of the Uhuru Radio website and send us your comment. And we'll read it over the air.
May I comment?
Yes.
You know, something. See, Africans in a place where too often we create a certain kind of concept of exceptionalism. Like everybody else got to fight for freedom except us. You know, if we learn to pray to the right gods, or if we learn where the secret documents are hidden, somehow buried long time ago by the white folks, that's going to free us. Nonsense. And the reality is that the world is changing right before our eyes. And the reason white power is in such a frenzy now is because we do live in a world that has been shaped by colonialism and slavery. And many of the former colonies, people who were colonized, are fighting to take back their resources. That's what the whole so-called war against terrorism that's all about. It's because the Arab people, the people in Latin America, other people are fighting to win their freedom. And that is something that, you know, we celebrate on the one hand. But on the other hand, just because other people are winning their freedom and changing their relationship to imperialism doesn't mean that it will bode well automatically for Africa and African people. What we have to do is help to shape what the future is going to look like by stepping forward as Africans to say, this is what the African nation is about. This is what constitutes the African nation. And this is how we have decided to make our history. Because we talk about the Arab thing as an example. And we cheer and celebrate the victory of the Arabs over imperialism. But the Arabs have their own history of oppression and annexation of Africa and African territories.
Yes.
And a success for Arabs against imperialism, independent of a struggle by African people in Africa and elsewhere to win our own national independence and to liberate Africa itself as the homeland of the African nation could result in negative, bad consequences for us in Africa. Yeah. We see the success of the Arabs and other people as something that can weaken imperialism, but just because you have a weak imperialism and stronger anti-imperialist forces, if Africa is not in the mix to finding our own future, it doesn't mean that the outcome is going to be good and or positive for us.
We got to have state power.
We got to have state power, and we got to be in the mix, and we got to be defining what this African nation is. Because when Nkrumah was alive, and it appeared in the 1960s that Africa was setting the terms for independence, many of the people who call themselves Arabs today were eager to identify with Africa.
Yes.
But it's an Africa that is on its knees now, that is being used and exploited with much vigor by the imperialist world.
Yes.
That you see an aggressive Arab nationalism that is emerging, that increasingly defined part of the national territory of the Arab people as part of North Africa. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So my struggle now is not one against the Arab people. It is a struggle for African people to engage imperialism in a fashion so that we can help shape the world that is now coming into existence as a consequence of people fighting to take back their resources and to take back their place in the world.
Yes, yes. And I think something that's important to note is something that you raise a lot, is the fact that throughout history, African people have influenced the struggle of African people for freedom. Have influenced other people's struggles for freedom. Even we were talking about Marcus Garvey and how, you know, people like Ho Chi Minh and other folk attended meetings of Garvey's, you know. And I think it's important, you know, one of the things that you said oftentimes, and even people like you're beginning to hear people like Chavez in Venezuela say, you know, Africa is central, you know, to the whole struggle around the world.
Yeah.
We've got 10 minutes left, and I wanna offer you the opportunity to make some closing statements.
I would like to mention two things. One is that there's a meeting at 4 o'clock today for Africans who may be in the Tampa Bay area in Florida, where we'll be continuing this discussion about Garvey and doing a real celebration of the legacy of Garvey and hoping to educate some people about that. But the other thing is that I would hope that Africans would join in with this effort to build an African Socialist International. Our future as a people is going to be determined by our success in liberating and uniting Africa and African people. And the most dynamic, meaningful process that I am aware of in that direction is the work to build the African Socialist International. Now, a lot of people, Africans around the world now, who are busy moving with all African processes, and in many ways, a lot of them, and perhaps most of them, are similar to the efforts by Du Bois during the time he was in a contest with the Garvey movement. And a lot of times, these are Africans who cannot see beyond the existing imperial order and who talk about uniting Africa because they see Africa as a big market that will allow them to develop industry and grow wealth, but will not necessarily change the relationship that the African workers and poor people have to our own resources, which have been forcibly extracted from us everywhere. A lot of them see freedom as being joining with the imperialist club and not for the destruction of imperialism, which is the only way that we will ever be free. So this is a call for people. I mean, you should go and check out the ASI, the African Socialist International, the website, which is at asiuhuru.org, There's a conference happening in London in October from the 6th through the 9th. If you can make it there, you ought to do so. There will be Africans there from throughout Africa and various places in Europe and North America and hopefully South America, depending on this issue of visas, people being able to get visas that will allow them into the imperialist countries. But this is the most important work that I am convinced is happening for African people in the world, and I would like to invite everybody to come and join this process. It's not good enough simply to listen to Marcus Garvey. We have a responsibility to live like Garvey, and so that is my call, and I hope that there are people listening to us who are open to move to actually do something, because that's what it's going to take for us to be free. So thank you so much, and like to just express my appreciation to all of the listeners to Uhuru Radio, and I will call on the listeners to help us build Uhuru Radio. You should let others know about this. If you appreciate what you hear on this radio station, you should tell friends and others about it. Help spread the word so that others can tune in and help to make this a successful institution for African people dispersed around the world. With that, I'd say Israele to Africa, and one Africa, one nation. Uhuru.
Uhuru. We appreciate the chairman coming on to the show today. I want to echo the call that the chairman made. I want to say that Garvey, you know, built an organization, economic capacity around the world, and he did so by organizing African people to contribute through their work, through sending in resources, you know, to build this movement, to build the Black Star Line, and other instances of the work that the Garvey movement did. In the same vein, we have to build Uhuru Radio. We have to build this capacity to broadcast the voice of the International African Revolution to every African around the world. And one of the things that you all can do, the listeners and supporters can do to participate in that process, you can, one, volunteer for Uhuru Radio in various forms, including reporters, including various other ways. You can also contribute financially to Uhuru Radio. If you go on the uhururadio.com website, click on Support Uhuru Radio. There's a pledge page. You can send in your donation. You can buy a credit card on the website, or you can send it to the P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 7693, St. Petersburg, Florida, 33734. And you can contribute in any other way that you see your capability to contribute to Uhuru Radio. I want to again appreciate our listeners for listening in, and call on everyone out there to not just celebrate folk like Marcus Garvey, but to become the carriers of the legacy of Marcus Garvey. Uhuru.
Children of moving right down to Babylon, and we're grooving to our father's land. Yeah, how good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification of all Rasta man. Yeah, as it's been said.
African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela's new book, One Africa, One Nation, is available now. In this historic collection, the chairman and representatives of the Emerging African Socialist International explain why Africa and all its resources must be liberated and in the hands of African workers and peasants in Africa and elsewhere. The chairman's new book, One Africa,